From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Money for Nothing, the case for universal basic income. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is a special rebroadcast of To the Point. Food stamps, housing vouchers, unemployment, they're mainstays of the American safety net. But as technology and the gig economy eat away at wages, more people fall through the cracks. Both liberals and conservatives are taking a new look at an old idea, giving every American a basic income and scrapping some or all government benefits. $10,000 in every pot, would it make a difference? We'll hear the debate. And today's talking point, 2016 was a year that professional forecasters would like to forget. Author Chuck Klosterman helps us think about the present like it's the past. First news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney, and Happy New Year, everyone. Just ahead on the show, universal basic income. It's an anti-poverty program that both the left and right have kicked around for decades. We'll revisit a recent debate we had on this show about the pros and cons of Uncle Sam cutting everyone a check. And later on today's talking point, 2016 is in the books, and it was a year of epic failure by expert forecasters. We'll ask author Chuck Klosterman how to think differently about the present and the future. First, the story. Get ready to hear a lot more about religious liberty issues in 2017. White religious voters in large part helped Donald Trump win the White House. And early this year, the Trump administration, backed by a Republican-controlled Congress, will take up pending religious liberty questions in all three branches of government. That's according to Emma Green. She covers politics, policy, and religion for The Atlantic.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we talk about these issues, could you flesh out Trump's mandate for us? Just how religious are these voters who back him in comparison to, say, Clinton voters? And do we know how they compare to Americans as a whole?
So one off-cited statistic from the breakdown of Trump's eventual supporters was that 81% of white self-identified evangelicals voted for Trump. And then additionally, 60% of white Catholics chose Trump. This, first of all, was a very strong religious showing from white religious voters. And also, more generally, Hillary Clinton's voters tended to be less religiously affiliated. Overall, Donald Trump did do a good job of winning over people who consider themselves religious in certain ways, and particularly conservatively religious.
Right. These are real church-going voters.
Absolutely. There was a theory early in the primaries that Donald Trump supporters who are religious didn't actually attend church. But that ended up in November not being true. There was still a high degree of church attendance among people who did vote for Donald Trump.
And how did the Supreme Court figure into the calculations of these religious voters in their choice of Trump? The fact that a number of seats will probably free up and he'll have such an opportunity to sway the direction of the court.
Even just going into office, this will be one of the first decisions that he makes, is nominating a new Supreme Court justice to replace Antonin Scalia. And according to exit polls, this was the top issue for many Americans, but even more so for Trump voters compared to Clinton voters. We also know, based on reporting I've done and other media outlets have done, that for many voters, one issue in particular stood out, and that was the issue of abortion, which the Supreme Court could weigh in on coming years.
Well, let's start with the states then, because as you say, this is going to come at us at all three branches of government. What are the big fights we should expect in the states straight away in 2017?
One fight that's already been happening, but that will almost certainly heat up in the coming couple of years, are state legislatures introducing new provisions that either create new legislation or additional measures to protect the religious conscience of religious business owners or others who are particularly concerned that new state mandates and new federal mandates on same-sex marriage may interfere with their religious beliefs. This tends to be framed in opposition to another type of legislation which proposes new rights for LGBT Americans in terms of housing and hiring and public accommodations. Groups like the ACLU are gearing up for big fights that pit these two groups against each other, religious conservatives and LGBT groups. The ACLU is doing training for journalists. They're doing a public education campaign. And in general, there's a lot of anticipation that states will be pursuing these issues.
And moving on to Congress, what religious liberty bills are on the 2017 docket?
There have already been murmurings that a piece of legislation that has previously been introduced, called the First Amendment Defense Act, will be reintroduced. This legislation, in addition to other pieces of legislation that have been attached as amendments to other issues, often tend to offer conscience exceptions for religious Americans who, again, have objections largely to same-sex marriage, but also to Americans whose religious beliefs say that sex should only happen between marriage. So they object to sex outside the context of marriage. And this is something that came up even in this last Congress. There was an amendment called the Russell Amendment attached to the regular reauthorization of defense spending. And that almost tanked the budget bill until the very last minute when Congress ended up passing that budget without the Russell Amendment attached to it.
And remind us, because President-elect Trump repeatedly on the campaign trail pledged to repeal the Johnson Amendment. What is that again?
So that's a 1954 provision to the tax code, which prohibits tax-exempt organizations, and that includes churches and religious groups, from getting involved in politicking, from making open endorsements of candidates or open opposition statements to candidates. This is something Trump talked about routinely, especially in front of religious audiences, was that he was going to lift the muzzle on preachers who wanted to talk about politics from the pulpit. This, of course, could have wide-ranging consequences, not just for church groups, but for all nonprofit groups and the way that they engage in politics.
Well, Emma, thanks for this rundown. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Emma Green, she covers politics, policy, and religion for The Atlantic. And coming up on the show, should the government guarantee every American a basic income? We'll hear the pros and cons. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. What if the government guaranteed everyone a basic amount of income, regardless whether you work or not? Let's just say $10,000. So if you were broke, it could at least help pay for a roof over your head. And if you didn't need it, you could put it away for an emergency. This idea has been kicking around since the 18th century, with some famous proponents more recently.
That is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
And some famous economists like Milton Friedman, who called it a negative income tax.
The proposal for a negative income tax is a proposal to help poor people by giving them money, which is what they need, rather than as now, by requiring them to come before a governmental official, detail all their assets and their liabilities, and be told that you may spend X dollars on rent, Y dollars on food, etc., and then be given a handout.
And that's Milton Friedman talking to William F. Buckley on the firing line in 1968. Now, this money would take the place of welfare, unemployment, maybe even housing vouchers and food stamps, all of which are costly and require big administrative costs. Andy Stern is former president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and he's the author of the new book, Raising the Floor, How a Universal Basic Income Can Renew Our Economy and Rebuild the American Dream. And it's great of you to join us on the show today.
Thank you.
So a long history to this idea, but it's never caught on in America. And now you have come to embrace it. Why now?
Well, I think two things are going on simultaneously. One is, despite all the welfare programs we see, we're seeing poverty continue to increase and inequality continue to increase. And so we have a system, and I was a welfare worker, so I would appreciate it, that really hasn't worked well for what its purpose was, which was to end poverty. And simultaneously, there's more and more reputable research that says that a tsunami of technological change is going to massively disrupt the job market. And so for a second reason, we need to provide some stability as a supplement, not really a substitute for employment. And so to end poverty and to provide stability in a changing world, I think a universal basic income is clearly the right idea.
Tell us more about the tsunami and how technology is changing work. And you say that the tipping point will be driverless trucks, as an example.
So first of all, the research is getting fairly overwhelming. We have McKinsey, Deloitte, Boston Consulting Group, Larry Summers, Bob Bryce, Joe Stiglitz, and the list can go on and on of people who are saying that we are going to have a disruption that I would say is far greater than what we saw in the Industrial Revolution. And if you take driverless trucks, for an example, which is the largest job in 29 states, there's 3.5 million truck drivers. There's 6.8 million people who support them in insurance and auto repairs, parts, restaurants, giving traffic tickets. So imagine as driverless trucks, which are now capable of going on the road or actually deployed, you know, what is going to happen to that nearly 10 million people? Or the Citi report that came out recently said that 2 million banking jobs will be eliminated by technology. These are massive changes that we're not prepared for.
Now, the classic line on this ever since computers and artificial intelligence, people started to dream of it, was that some jobs will go away, but new jobs, better paying in technology, will replace them.
Well, I think that's a wonderful debate for academics and the elite to have. And sadly, when they're wrong, it's working people who pay the price. So I would rather take stock with what the military and business does, which is create scenarios, which creates alternative plans so that if that moment arises, and I think it will, that we're prepared. We saw what happened when the economy crashed in 2009 and we tried to deploy very quickly a stimulus program, which was not as effective as it could have been. We know that a huge potential of change is coming our way. You know, why wouldn't we prepare? Why wouldn't we do what the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, is doing, which is beginning to think about experimenting in parts of the country, as we did with Milton Friedman and Richard Nixon, to look at, is this a better way to both end poverty and is this a way to provide stability? I think we can do that without having to answer the question of what I think will soon become the climate deniers.
How does the universal basic income work?
Well, my proposal is fairly simple, and I think we'll hear some of the differences on this program. The current poverty level is $11,900 a year for an individual. So I say let's give everybody $1,000 a month. That's $12,000 a year, enough to end poverty as it's officially evaluated by the federal government. You know, $24,000 for a family of two, that we should top up people on Social Security who are making less than that through their check, and that we should just have a floor, like many middle-class children do, including my own, where parents help pay for vacations or pay for an unexpected expense. I call it parental basic income. And I think we should have universal basic income so everyone has that kind of floor and stability underneath them.
Well, why make it universal? Why not only give it to people who really need it, say, the bottom half of the economic scale?
Well, I think we've tried welfare programs, and we've understood that there's something where when only a few people get things, or a significant number of people in the case right now get things, they're always under attack. I mean, we're drug testing now people who are on unemployment insurance in certain parts of the country. So let's look at Alaska, where they've had a dividend from the oil resources that is now almost 50 years old. And that program has been enduring and not constantly under attack like our current welfare system. Or let's look at Social Security, which has a financing problem, but no one's saying, let's get rid of Social Security. That's not true about so many other welfare programs. And as a British social scientist once said, any policy for the poor only is poor policy. And I think that's true. Universality can be dealt with through the tax system. Milton Friedman and other people had their own ideas. Some people on this program have other ideas. But I think that's an issue for the tax system, but it should be universal to start with.
Well, let's get to some of those other ideas. This is Andy Stern, author of Raising the Floor. Bob Greenstein joins me now. He's president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That's a liberal group researching fiscal policy issues that reduce poverty and income inequality. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Well, you've made the case that let's just call it UBI, universal basic income, that it sounds good, but that it's more likely to increase poverty than reduce it. So spin that out for us. Why is that?
So I very much agree with Andy's goals, but I'm very much a skeptic on universal basic income for three key reasons. One, I think its massive cost likely makes it a pipe dream that'll never happen. Number two, the only way I think you can get around the political obstacles is to design it in a way that probably makes poverty and inequality worse. And third, I think it competes with and distracts us from more feasible steps forward towards the same kind of goals that I would love to see us take. So let me explain. First, let's say you gave everybody in America $10,000 a year. Even if you counted that as taxable income, so you taxed a portion back for people in the income tax system, you're still talking about close to $3 trillion a year in new cost. Well, that's about two-thirds of the entire federal budget. It's about double the entire budget outside Social Security, Medicare, defense, and interest payments. Where would the money come from? It's not conceivable to me that you could get agreement from the American political system and indeed the American people to raise taxes that much, especially when we're already going to need more revenue to shore up Social Security, repair the infrastructure, and the like. And the only support for universal basic income that exists on the right or conservative side of the political spectrum is predicated on eliminating most or all programs for low and moderate income people as a way to pay for most or all of universal basic income.
So are we talking about getting rid of food stamps and Head Start and programs
like that?
Food
stamps, school lunch, Head Start, child care, rental vouchers to make housing affordable in high-rent markets, Pell Grants so low-income kids can afford to go to college, foster care, job training. The list goes on and on. And if you take the resources from those programs, and by the way, the resources overwhelmingly go for those benefits. If you look at the key benefit programs, SNAP, food stamps, Medicaid, and the like, actually, administrative costs eat up only 1-9%. Most of the money in those big benefit programs goes to people in need. And if you take that money and use it instead to finance equal payments that go to people all the way up the income scale, you actually leave less at the bottom. So I would like to see us instead focus on things like shoring up Social Security for the long term and improving benefits for low-income workers, infrastructure and job programs, enhanced investment in child care, college and housing affordability, and things like that. And while I know Andy is talking about the long term, I just worry a little bit about people getting distracted potentially from concrete gains that I would hope could be achieved in the years to come to help push back more against poverty and inequality.
Let's turn back to Andy Stern, author of Raising the Floor, former president of the SEIU. And Andy, if we were to enact your idea of $12,000 for every family of two, a universal basic income, and if it, what do you think of it requiring that we end these other programs? And I've seen this inequality, this income inequality transfer of funding going two-thirds towards the top level, the top of the economic chain, and only one-third going toward those on the bottom, and to, just to spell out how this would lead to more inequality as opposed to less.
So first of all, this is simply a design problem, and clearly it costs money. You know, my calculation, because I don't include, as Bob does, people on Social Security, I don't include children under 18, you know, gets us to a different number that I think is much more easy, and I spell it in my book, lots of different ways that you can afford it. It's expensive, but the instability that's going to be created in this country, if there's a continued disruption of jobs and inequality and lack of wages, I think it's going to be far greater than what it's going to cost to try to provide some stability. And yes, I do. I was a welfare worker. I happen to agree with Martin Luther King that we created all these categorical programs in order to substitute for what it really takes to end poverty is give people money. And so I think it's perfectly fair to discuss, you know, which programs you're going to eliminate. I would eliminate food stamps and unemployment insurance and some very clear basic transfers of the 122 cash programs we do have in the country. And I do think this is more of an issue 5 to 10 to 15 years from now than it is today. I think there are lots of what I call in my book mitigating policies, many of which Bob talked about, raising the minimum wage or others. But in the long run, you know, employment-based programs, work-based programs, in a world where alternative work arrangements, non-full-time work is becoming the norm, are just not going to work effectively. And giving people an earned income tax credit once a year for several thousand dollars is not going to be enough, you know, when people are really going to have a much harder time finding regular full-time employment. So let's think about the future. Let's not be careless in terms of spending money where we don't need to do it. But I think this is a design question, and Bob and I and others are having the right debate. But going back to a world of categorical welfare programs, Martin Luther King and Milton Friedman were right. That's not the way, the kind of choices we want to give people in today's society.
Well, let's bring in another voice. Véronique de Rougy is Senior Research Fellow at the Libertarian Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as a libertarian, you like this better than what we have now. How is it an improvement?
Oh, I think, I liked a lot of what Andy had to say. I have also a lot of concern as to the cost, even though that's like pretty low on my list. But I will say we don't have to actually project ourselves in the future in a world where there's 46% unemployment. These are some of the estimates I've seen, to actually think that the current system is not working. It's really not working, and it's not treating people with dignity. And as such, a guaranteed minimum income or universal basic income is definitely an improvement, because giving money, and again, the many different ways to design the system, respect the dignity of the recipients. There's like this assumption with the different category of welfare is that because you're poor, supposedly you have to have a Washington bureaucrat telling you how much you can spend on food and how much you can spend on housing and how much you can spend on this and that is just not right to me. I think we need to start treating people like adults, not children, and in fact, when you treat people like adults and they're not too paternalistic, you'll tend to see that people act like adults. So this is really an idea that is very appealing to libertarians.
And hold that thought, because we're going to take a break now, and then we'll come back and discuss this some more. And we're talking about the idea of a universal income and the appeal on all ends of the political spectrum after the break. And later on our talking point, 2016, it's in the books, and it was a year of epic failure by expert forecasters. We'll ask Chuck Klosterman, author of But What If We're Wrong, about how to think differently about the present and the future. So stay with us for that on To the Point from Public Radio International. The This is To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Back now to our conversation about the anti-poverty idea of a universal basic income and whether providing every American or families a state stipend is a good approach to solving income inequality. Also, how it would affect the economy, whether Americans want it, and at what cost. Véronique de Rougy was just making a point. She is senior research fellow at the Libertarian Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and she was talking about how universal basic income is less paternalistic, allows people more dignity and respect from the government in how they manage their lives and spend their money. And I'd like you to finish that point and also tell us how you would pay for it, because we're arguing about the design of a program.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the current system is just not sustainable. It's not good at so many levels. It hasn't done the job properly, and it's demeaning, I think.
Do you point the finger at liberals for this?
I mean,
have the ability to make the good decisions?
I've talked to a lot of people, because in spite of my reservation about the guaranteed minimum income, which I will explain right now, but I've had talked to a lot of liberals and Republicans, and the main criticism that I always hear, apart from the cost and work disincentive, is like, these people don't know. Well, you know, people are going to be like using drugs or spending it on coke or whatever, like on unhealthy food. And I'm kind of like stunned by these type of reaction, because it's assuming that just because you're poor, you don't have the good sense of actually knowing what is good for you, or you don't want to do what's best for your children. And I'm not saying that a lot of people are not going to make stupid choices, but it is the right of each one of us to actually make these choices and learn from them, or live with the consequences. And it's just, I think the alternative system is just not working. But I do have reservation about this issue, because it is horribly expensive, and that may not be too much of a problem, because I actually think we are a wealthy society, and the thing we should be doing is, one of the things that the government should be doing is that, or as a society we should be doing, is take care of people who really can't take care of themselves. But my real problem with it is this would require us to get rid of all the other anti-poverty programs, and I just don't see that happening credibly, and then that makes it even more expensive. And even if by some political miracle we got rid of everything implemented, I just don't see how we keep the system pure and not having a lot of programs coming back and piling on. And that is a guaranteed, it's a guaranteed financial disaster.
Let's turn back to Bob Greenstein, the president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I'm curious what your thoughts are about Véronique de Rougy's point that the poor are underestimated and disrespected in current anti-poverty programs and safety net programs.
Well, I think there are two issues here. The history in this country has been that politically, the American public has not been willing to provide substantial cash assistance to poor people, particularly people who are out of work, and has been much more willing to provide things like food stamps, which are very flexible. You can use them for any food, but to do that rather than cash. But, you know, having said that, some of the forms of support now simply could not be replaced by a $12,000 UBI. Take a couple that has significant child care costs in order to go work. Child care couldn't readily be afforded, along with all kinds of other needs, out of that amount. Or you have to go to college and you need a Pell Grant to help you afford college. And most of all, health insurance, which is extremely expensive. So unless you're going to cause very severe damage to a lot of people at the bottom of the income scale, you can't get rid of things like child care or college assistance or health care coverage. So that's a big problem for starters. And the second problem is when you look at it, for example, a fellow libertarian of Veronique's did an analysis of how much of a universal basic income you could afford if you eliminated every single program to help low or moderate income people outside of health coverage. And he found it would afford $1,580 per person per year. That's substantially less than we provide most low-income families today that get assistance through things like food stamps or school meals or a rental voucher or the like. And the reason you can only afford much less than they would currently get is you're using some of the money to provide these basic payments all the way up the income scale. I don't think people like myself or the other panelists on this call need to get X thousand dollars a year in universal basic income. And that the need to provide money in annual payments of multi-thousand dollars to people well up the income scale who don't need it is what makes this so expensive and puts effective programs for low-income people at risk of being abolished in order to finance a universal basic income.
Bob Greenstein with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Let's turn to Dylan Matthew. He's a journalist at Vox, and he's reported extensively on universal income. And while we're debating how this might work or whether this would happen, there are already experiments in the works. Dylan, tell us about them.
Sure. So we're sort of in the middle of a second golden age of basic income experiments. There was a first round that Andy Stern alluded to earlier in the 70s, where the U.S. and Canada ran a number of experiments. And now you have a pilot that's starting in Finland next year. The province of Ontario in Canada, where Toronto is in the process of launching one. The investment firm Y Combinator is going to be running a trial in Oakland. And I think the most exciting one is a charity known as GiveDirectly, which does direct cash grants to poor people in Kenya and Uganda, is going to be doing a very large-scale trial in Kenya. And that's particularly exciting because for relatively low money, you can provide a poverty-level basic income on sort of global poverty standards, sort of $1 to $2 a day, at what is a pretty small budget by Western standards, but is more affordable in the context of budgets for these poor countries. And so I think if that works out, this will be a really exciting policy idea for developing world governments to consider.
That don't already have an infrastructure of safety net programs in place, too. So it's a completely different scenario. But what have we learned from these experiments so far? And often the criticism for how it would work or whether it would work here in America is that it destroys the incentive to work.
So unfortunately, there's still debate over what the studies actually said. I think the best reading of the evidence is that there is a mild or none effect on work. That I think the best study was one that was done in a town called Dauphin in Manitoba, Canada. And they found that there were reductions in work effort for teenagers who focused more intensely on their studies and for new mothers who used sort of time off paid for by the basic income as a kind of maternity leave. And I think you'll see a lot of that you'll see people going on more extended unemployment streaks because they're taking more time to search for a job that matches their interests more closely. I think in practice, work is a force that gives people tremendous meaning. And until we get the kind of transition that Andy's talking about, if we get that kind of transition, people are still going to want to work because it's a thing that makes them part of society and that gives them purpose. And I don't think basic income would change that.
And what do we know about how it contributes to solving the problem of income inequality?
Well, I think one basic math thing is that if you give everyone in a country the same amount of money, percentage-wise, that's a much bigger boost for people at the bottom than it is for people up the brackets. And I think that's particularly true if you finance it through increases in income taxes or estate taxes for the wealthy. Now, there is not enough money among wealthy people to finance it entirely through that. But I think most of the approaches I've seen would be heavily progressive. The think tank Compass in the UK recently came out with a report that found that I think the bottom 70% of the income distribution would benefit under their plan, and there'd be sharp losses at the very top.
Let's turn back to Bob Greenstein, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You're our resident skeptic. What do you make of the findings of the experiment so far?
Well, I don't think we know that much from the experiment so far. They're in other countries. They may or may not be applicable here. But I wanted to come back to Dylan's last point. I think, I would imagine, that all of us on the call would agree that the impact of a universal basic income on inequality depends to an important degree on how it's financed. So Dylan is certainly right that if you financed it largely by raising taxes on people at the top, the overall effect would certainly be progressive and to reduce inequality. The reason I think that's very unlikely to occur is that we can't look at UBI in isolation. We have to look at it relative to other revenue needs we already have. We have substantial revenue needs to close long-term shortfalls in Social Security and Medicare. We have substantial revenue needs to finance major infrastructure repair, which we very badly need. We have a number of other unmet needs in the country. We need to improve our education system. I would invest more in revitalizing depressed inner city areas and the like. And there's only so much money we're going to get from people high on the income scale. And if you deal with those other issues first, we are going to have to deal with Social Security and Medicare and ultimately infrastructure. I'm very skeptical that politically in our system, which is different than Western Europe or a much lower tax country than Western Europe, I'm very skeptical that there would be political room left to do significant revenue raising to finance UBI at the top.
Let's hear from Andy Stern on that. Andy, you're the author of Raising the Floor and the former president of the SEIU, and you've been talking to people all over the country about basic, universal basic income. This is the big question with UBI, whether there's the political will to push something like this through.
When we're dealing with programs that are universal, like Medicare and Social Security, there is far more will to deal with it than even infrastructure, and certainly for people that are poor. And I think we need to think of this era that's about to arise much more like the Vietnam War era than the Iraq War era. In the Vietnam War, people like myself, middle class, then students, got a draft number. Everyone got a draft number. You could not escape the potential of serving your country. In the Iraq War, we farmed that out to an all-volunteer army. And all of a sudden, middle class and upper middle class parents and kids sort of weren't involved. It was someone else's problem. What we don't want to appreciate sometimes is that technological change is hitting white-collar workers even harder right now and in the future than blue-collar workers. They've already paid the price with automation and globalization, but now we're talking about accountants, lawyers, doctors, adjunct professors. The list goes on, stock traders. This is now going to be a Vietnam War era where the middle class and upper middle class kids graduating from very good schools like where I spend some time, Columbia, where about a third of the kids are having a very difficult time finding a job. They never had that problem before because they used to be stock traders and stock analysts, jobs that don't exist anymore on Wall Street. And so I think we're going to have a politically different moment than we have today. And the question becomes, just like healthcare, where everyone's second choice is do nothing, is whether or not we can find a way between libertarians, progressives, conservatives, all the different ranges in the political spectrum to find a way to design a program that actually serves a purpose for our country, that gives people choice and opportunity, that supplements, not substitutes for work. And I don't think there's any chance in the world to do it if it's not universal.
Well, that's all the time we have for the conversation. Andy Stern, I want to thank you, author of Raising the Floor. Also, thanks to all of my guests. In just a moment, with 2016 in the books, we'll look for some perspective on the year behind us and the year ahead with Chuck Klosterman. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. I'm Barbara Bogave here with today's Talking Point. Well, looking back now, 2016 seems to be the year so many of us got so much so wrong. Brexit, Trump, low-fat dairy, Ken Bone, for God's sakes. Prognosticating, it's never been something humans excel at. I mean, where is my hot tub time machine? Chuck Klosterman has some ideas about why we go so far off the mark when we try to imagine the future in science or culture or politics. But, of course, there's a pretty good chance that he's wrong, too. He's author of But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as Though It Were the Past. And he's going to help us think about 2017 like it's the past. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here.
I hope that even made sense. Anyway, first, do you agree with what I just said? Does 2016 stand out for you, too, as or was it just another year of failed imagination?
Well, I mean, it was a strange year by almost any standard. It just, first you have the idea of, did it even seem possible in this day and age that there could be an upset in the presidential election? It's just, I'd gotten to this point in my life where I thought, well, some things are kind of static, and we can just kind of anticipate. You know, the election was almost like when that Malaysian jet disappeared. We're all like, can this still happen? Can we still just lose jets? Can we still be wrong about an election?
Well, right, and I noticed back in June when your book came out, someone asked you whether you could make a prediction about anything happening this year that would withstand your own analysis, and you said, I don't think so, but I will say I don't think it's mathematically possible for Trump to win the election.
Well, I didn't at the time. I thought that what needed to happen was people who had voted for Obama not only not vote for Clinton, but decide to vote for Trump, which seemed like an impossibility through any sort of kind of logical means, but that is precisely what happened.
Well, let's relate this to your theory that you put forth in the book and what we get so wrong about thinking about the future. And as far as politics goes, Brexit and the U.S. election do exemplify some of your thesis about how we don't think about the future the right way. And you say part of that problem is that we live in an age of casual certitude. What do you mean by casual certitude, and how does it fit into your larger principle about what we get wrong?
We look at the present tense differently than we look at history. The criteria we use to sort of understand the value of something in the living present is very different than the criteria we use when we look back on something kind of from this long lens. So when you look at Brexit or you look at Trump or whatever, okay, right now, you're using Trump as the example. It would seem as though the thing that everyone sort of, or many people seem to accept, is that even if you're a supporter of him, he is the least qualified person to ever become president. We've never really had someone who's never held office before and sort of, you know, can get the highest office through this way. Now, here's what we might be wrong about from a long view. When we look back in 100 or 300 or 1,000 years, did we overestimate the importance of the presidency? Let's say that we get through 4 or 8 years of Trump and nothing really changes, though that there are small sort of political movements and political footballs fought back and forth, that for the most part, everything kind of remains as it is. That might indicate that in the present tense, we are overemphasizing the importance of the commander-in-chief and the executive officer and all this. It's the same thing with Brexit. What if in 10 years, life in England is not that different than life in England now? Would that suggest that being part of, you know, the European Union maybe was less meaningful than we thought? I don't know. This is what I talk about when I say the way we think about historical moments is very different than the way we think about living moments.
Right, and reframing the present. And one of my favorite organizations is the Long Now Foundation, which pretty much does what you're talking about. They think long-term into the future in tens and hundreds and thousands of years in order to get a different perspective on the present. But it's a hard thing to do, and you came up with a principle about how to do it better, and you call it Klosterman's razor, which is defined as the best hypothesis is the one that reflexively accepts its potential wrongness to begin with.
It's kind of the inverse of like Occam's razor. You know, if you talk to, say, a lawyer or a cop or something about some situation, they will often argue, well, if we don't know what the answer to this problem is, let's select the scenario with the least amount of variables. The simplest answer is best. The thing that has the least possibilities for any kind of surprise, you know. This is sort of like a tool of the rational person. But the fact of the matter is, reality is not rational. Life is not rational. The world does not seem to unspool in a rational way. So within this book, what I would often do is I would take a question and I would say, well, what seems to be the obvious answer? What's the answer that we're sort of unconsciously accepting to be true and then immediately discount it based on the fact that the history of ideas is the history of people being wrong? It seems as though the obvious conclusion is the one that almost never happens. And that's, once you remove that, you start looking at other things that could occur once you've taken away the most obvious possibility.
Well, it's interesting. In the book, and you're a culture critic, so this makes sense, you spend some time on this point debating whether the Beatles or Chuck Berry will be remembered hundreds of years from now as the definition of rock and roll, right?
Yeah.
You argue that the Beatles is the obvious answer, and that's why it's probably wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you might say, like, well, what's your basis that seems so backwards to say that the worst answer is the one that seems like the best answer? But what I was trying to do is this. I was thinking, like, well, okay, you look at somebody like John Philip Sousa. He's the only creator of marching music almost anyone is aware of in this era. Marching music used to be huge. Now it's just sort of part of the collective memory. And if you ask someone to name someone who came up with marches, they'll either come up with no one or Sousa. He's now interchangeable with the music itself. He is as famous as marching music. And eventually this will happen with rock music, too. In 400 years, there'll be some, you know, I imagine this collegiate classroom where they're talking about the history of music or the history of the late 20th century, and they'll talk about this idea that was so important to youth culture, this thing that sort of emerged in 1950 and sort of existed for whatever number of years, 75 years, 90 years. It'll be foreign to every kid in that classroom. In order to explain what rock music is, they'll probably use one individual to sort of be a metaphor for the whole idea. My sort of conclusion is, even though it feels like that answer is and should be the Beatles, Chuck Berry, from a historical sense, probably is a better conclusion to draw. Because what will likely happen is rock music will just be a collection of tropes, qualities of rock music that we all sort of associate with what the art form was, and he fulfills all of them. He's almost like the perfect definition of what the cliche or caricature of rock music is. And that seems to be what defines history.
So isn't this a bit of a thought experiment, really, or just like hedging your bets or puts and calls in stock market terms, you know, a way of influencing your imagination when you think about culture and taste?
Short answer is yes. I mean, that's part of the reason why I was able to get a lot of interesting people to be interviewed for this book. People are very willing to be interviewed about something that they cannot be wrong about because we'll all be dead. If you ask someone to speculate on the world in 300 years, anyone will be like, sure, give me a shot, you know? I guess the longer answer would be that I do think that there is a real benefit to looking at ourselves and saying that we're not at the apex of knowledge, even though that's how we live. You know, every generation believed that. The example that I often use is, you know, our understanding of gravity. Well, for Aristotle was the first person to sort of forward an idea about gravity, his idea being rocks don't float because rocks like to sit on the ground. They have agency. They want to be at the center of the universe, and the Earth is the center of the universe, so rocks don't float because they want to be on the ground. You tell that to someone, and they chuckle and say, like, oh, that seems idiotic. Like, for 2,000 years, we believed that. For 2,000 years, that made more sense than anything else. Our current understanding of gravity starts in the 1600s. It seems almost irrefutable, but there's a real logic gap in this. that we could be wrong about something for so long, but now, of course, we're the ones who are right. I think it's kind of humbling to accept that.
Yeah, but isn't there a danger to this kind of logic? And you do spend some time for the book with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he was very resistant to your thesis and got upset about it because he thought it could be used to defend climate change denial, for instance.
Well, it's true. I mean, any idea taken to its absolute extreme is probably dangerous. I think what he assumed is that I was trying to do a different book than I was. I think he suspected that I was trying to do a book where the conclusion would be like, hey, science is just made up. We don't know anything. What I was really saying is here's somebody who really understands the way the world works, and his understanding basically is my understanding. I accept his view of the world. But I wonder how someone in this position looks at their life and looks at their life's work and says, what is the possibility that what I'm doing is incorrect in the same way so many people before me have failed? You know, is it dangerous? Does it allow someone to say, like, I'm going to refuse or, you know, I'm not going to accept what seems to be obviously true? I don't know if the person who's going to do that would be interested in this book anyways.
Well, from the sublime to the very not sublime, it's the season for all the best of roundups for films and books and music, right? And you take such a long view on matters of taste. I'm imagining you looking over these best ofs 50 years or 500 years from now. I'm curious if you're seeing those lists in a completely different light after writing this book, and if you have any examples of that for us.
Well, I mean, sure. You know, like Citizen Kane didn't win an Academy Award. Star Wars didn't win an Academy Award. You know, yet when you look at the films from their respective periods, it's pretty clear which ones remain.
And from this year?
Okay, we got to apply the same logic then. Okay, so what will be perceived as like the best film from this year? Well, could be Manchester by the Sea, could be Moonlight. There's a whole bunch of, you know, possible things. But what will ultimately be the movie that is most meaningful over time will, oddly, be the film that comes to symbolize something outside of itself, that will take on a meaning that isn't directly tied to its content or its narrative or its theme. You see this over and over again, that the things that last tend to be things that aren't just appreciated for what they are, but for what they can be interpreted by people who have yet to be born, who can look back on this and say, we understand this period better through the lens of this book or this movie or this song or whatever.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Chuck Klosterman, he's the author of But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as Though It Were the Past. And that'll do it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.